Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 604. This program is being recorded on July 15th of the year 2007. The title of the broadcast, by the way, is Kicking Over the Traces. A short time ago, I got an email from a listener who was in school and was doing a little research about Martin Bormann and came across any one of a number of sources that discussed a DNA test that purported in the late 1990s to demonstrate conclusively that remains found in the ruins of Berlin, presumably interred near the end of World War II, were in fact those of Martin Bormann, who, according to this finding, had now been positively identified to be the remains or the identity of the remains found in the courtyard and consequently, or in the freight yard in Berlin, and consequently the individual who was killed in early 1945. As much as I talk about the Bormann Organization, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, which is not only the economic and political component of the Third Reich gone underground in mafia-like fashion, but it is also arguably the most important and powerful outcropping of an international cartel system which helped to spawn fascism and the Axis powers of World War II, and one of whose outcroppings is the Bormann Capital Network. I think that it would be worth going into, the official version of Bormann's death and the machinations that underlie that, simply by way of shedding some light not only on the reality behind the official history of the quote death unquote of Martin Bormann near the end of World War II, but also some of the study of how Bormann's death was faked is also a very, very good vehicle for studying propaganda and official state deception. Now, again, the official version has it that Martin Bormann was killed in the explosion of a tank. Martin Bormann, by the way, was the Reichsleiter of the Third Reich and arguably the most powerful person in Nazi Germany in its above-ground phase, and certainly the most powerful person in Nazi Germany in its post-World War II underground phase. Officially, he was, that is to say, Bormann was killed in the explosion of a tank as he was attempting to exit Berlin as the Russians were entering. In point of fact, the remains that were used for the DNA test in the late 1990s have a very interesting history indeed, and perhaps for our purposes and other circumstances, perhaps one of the most interesting aspects of those remains is that after the announcement by the German government that DNA taken from blood relatives of Bormann had matched the DNA taken from these remains found in Berlin and purporting to be Bormann, the remains of, quote, Bormann, unquote, were disposed of, purportedly in order to keep German neo-Nazis from commemorating the place of his remains interment as sort of a shrine. But the fact of the matter remains that, no pun intended, that after the DNA tests were announced in the German press with no adequate sort of scientific or legal controls, those remains were then disposed of in a secret place so that now the findings of that particular announcement can't be objectively second-checked. Now, for those people who may be new to the discussion, we're going to be talking about some allegations that surfaced in a landmark book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. That book was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart in 1981. It is available for download for free on the Spitfire website. There's also about a 10 or 12 page summation of the book in the description for the Record 305, plus a professional biography of Paul Manning. Now, younger listeners and older listeners as well may be familiar with the recent motion picture Good Night and Good Luck. That movie was about the career of the late Edward R. Murrow, a groundbreaking investigative journalist for CBS News. During World War II, Murrow became famous internationally for his broadcasts done on the Second World War in Europe, and in particular, his coverage of the Blitzkrieg air war against London and other British cities during the Battle of Britain in 1940 and 41. Murrow gathered around him a group of journalists who became known as Murrow's Boys. They actually held the rank of officer in the U.S. military, and one of Murrow's boys was Paul Manning. Paul Manning trained as a gunner first on aircraft that flew in the European theater in World War II, and later on B-29s in order to cover, respectively, the air war over Western Europe during World War II and the air war over Japan. Credited with actually shooting down enemy aircraft, Paul Manning broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network at the end of World War II, and did the same thing with Japan. He broadcast its surrender on the CBS radio network as well. Even before the guns fell silent, Manning had undertaken his research of what had happened to Reichsleiter Martin Bormann, and in analyzing the material that you're about to hear, note that Bormann's informants stretch over a period of, for the better part of 30 years, and had similar things to say. So about the official finding of the DNA test confirming that the remains found in a rail yard in Berlin, again purporting to be those of Martin Bormann, killed in early 1945 at the end of World War II, we're now going to cover what that actually was. What happened in a nutshell was that some inmates at the Sachsenhausen concentration camp who bore a strong physical resemblance, or a physical resemblance, we should say, to Martin Bormann, were treated by Dr. Hugo Blaschke, who was Bormann and Hitler's personal dentist, and their dental work was rearranged to look like that of Martin Bormann. And in point of fact, the dental work was even done on them while they were alive over a period of months, so that the dentures would show, their dental work would show the requisite amount of wear that occurs from the usage of dental work by a living human being. They were then killed using a special cyanide spray, and their remains were planted in the ruins of Berlin. In the early 1970s, when the investigative trail into Martin Bormann's whereabouts began to heat up, and in particular when Ladislaus Farrago was in Latin America researching Bormann's whereabouts, the disinformation effort that has been overseen by former Gestapo chief and Bormann's security director Heinrich Mueller over the years was cranked up to a new level of intensity. Not only was an operation set up, which we'll talk about at the end of the broadcast, to discredit Ladislaus Farrago, but also at the same time, the surfacing of Bormann's remains, the very same, quote, remains, unquote, which in the late 90s were identified through this DNA test, or, quote, identified through this DNA test, they were discovered after a leak from some of the Bormann/Mueller group's SS operatives. We're going to turn now to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and of the gambit whereby the dental work of people resembling Martin Bormann physically was altered to look like Bormann's. They were then killed and their remains planted in the ruins of Berlin as the war was coming to an end. We read in Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile as follows. Mueller's scheme of substituting a stand-in for Martin Bormann's body in the freight yards of Berlin was told to me three different times by three different individuals. One was an agent whose career was in the Secret Intelligence Service of the British Foreign Office, one served in the Federal Republic of Germany, and one was a member of Mossad, the exterior service of Israeli intelligence. The first tip came over dinner in 1947 in the U.S. Press Club in Frankfurt. It was the day I returned from Berlin and a personal meeting with General Lucius D. Clay, military governor of the U.S. zone of occupation. General Clay had offered me the position of his civilian deputy, but I had turned it down with some reluctance, preferring to remain a European reporter for American newspapers. During the press club dinner, the British agent and I discussed the fascinating and bizarre disappearance of Reichsleiter Bormann. This source said flatly that Mueller had engineered Bormann's escape using the device of a concentration camp lookalike to throw future investigators off the scent. Many years later, in 1973, the first tip, by the way, was 1947, beginning again, many years later in 1973, on a visit to Bonn, a conversation with one of General Galen's aides in the Federal Public Intelligence Service confirmed the 1947 British tip. The German intelligence officer stated, quote, "The skull represented as Bormann's is a fraud. Naturally, the West German government wishes to bury the past and establish Bormann's death once and for all. They have been constantly unsettled by continued revelations and scandals," unquote. In 1978, an Israeli Mossad agent with a German specialization said to me that they had never closed the Bormann file in Tel Aviv. Quote, "We know he is in South America. We are not very compelled to find him because he was never personally involved in the final solution." The Israeli added, quote, "Bormann's business was business, and from what I know personally, he did a thorough job of shifting German assets away from the Third Reich." Skipping down, of the visit by Heinrich Müller to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp and his selection of two men who bore a physical resemblance to Bormann to be the dental doubles, so to speak, whose dental work was to be altered to look like Bormann so that after they were killed and their remains planted in the ruins of Berlin, they could later be dug up on a tip and identified as, quote, Bormann, unquote, from their dental records. Returning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. When Heinrich Müller visited Sachsenhausen, he walked through the engraving, printing, and document areas looking for any inmates who might resemble Bormann. In one, he noticed two individuals who did bear a resemblance in stature and facial structure to the Reichsleiter. He had them placed in separate confinement. Thereupon, a special dental room was made ready for treatment, unquote, of the two men. A party dentist was brought in to work over and over again on the mouth of each man until his teeth, real and artificial, matched precisely the Reichsleiter's. In April of 1945, upon completion of these alterations, the two victimized men were brought to the Kurfürstenstrasse building to be held until needed. Dr. Blaschke, again the personal dentist to both Hitler and Bormann, beginning again, Dr. Blaschke had advised Müller to use live inmates to ensure a believable aging process for dentures and gums. Hence, the need for several months of preparation. Skipping down, speaking of Dr. Blaschke, Dr. Hugo Blaschke was the dentist who had served both Hitler and Bormann. It was to be of significance, beginning again, exact dental fidelity was to play a major part in the identification of Hitler's body by the invading Russians. It was to be of significance in Frankfurt 28 years later, when the West German government staged a press conference to declare that they had, quote, found Bormann's skeleton, proving he had died in Berlin's freight yards on May 1st to 2nd, 1945. Dr. Hugo Blaschke was the dentist who had served both Hitler and Bormann. Skipping down. In Bormann's case, the problem was more complex and more challenging than that of Hitler. Yet, under Mueller's skillful guidance, two bodies were planted. Their discovery was made possible when an SS man, acting on Mueller's orders, leaked the information to a Stern magazine editor as part of a ploy to prove, unquote, that Bormann had died in the Berlin freight yard. The stand-ins for Bormann were two unfortunates from concentration camp Sachsenhausen who had been killed gently in the Gestapo basement secret chambers with cyanide spray blown from a cigarette lighter, a killing device used later by the KGB in 1957 and 1959 against Lev Rebet and Stefan Bandera, two leaders of the Ukrainian émigré in Munich. At Gestapo headquarters, the night of April 30th, the bodies were taken by a special SS team to the freight yards under the Wiedendamm Bridge and buried not too deep beneath rubble in two different places. The Gestapo squad then made a hurried retreat from Berlin, joining their leader, SS Senior General Heinrich Müller, in Flensburg. The funeral and burial caper was to be a Müller trademark throughout the years of searching for Martin Bormann. The Mossad was to point out that they had been witnesses over the years to the exhumation of no fewer than 6 skeletons, 2 in Berlin and 4 in South America, purported to be that of Martin Bormann. All turned out to be those of others, although in Frankfurt in 1973, the dental technician Fritz Echtmann, after years as a Russian prisoner, was to say that the dental work found in the skull of the skeleton declared to be the remains of Bormann resembled those fillings he had worked on in 1944. Simon Wiesenthal, director of the Jewish Documentation Center in Vienna, had been invited to Frankfurt by West German authorities who were presenting the press event with the CIA in the background. He said that while the skull resembled Bormann's, he doubted it was Bormann's. Still, Heinrich Müller had done his job well, and from South America he pointed the Bonn government's investigators through intermediaries toward this second planted Bormann skeleton. So, by sources state, the fabrications of 1945 continued to provide the party minister with his, quote, passport to freedom, unquote. And, by the way, the death scenario has been used by a number of the post-war Nazi underground, including Mueller himself, who eventually, he was said to have died in the ruins of Berlin as well at the end of World War II. And yet, when his grave was opened, it was found to contain no fewer than 3 skeletons, none of which had any real physical resemblance to Heinrich Müller. So his exact whereabouts was never precisely determined, despite the established official method or mythology to the contrary. And again, the remains that were tested in the DNA test that was administered or overseen by the German government in the late 1990s, and which constitutes the official truth, so to speak, about the death of Martin Bormann, that official truth, so to speak, is basically an official lie. But the corpse that was used in those tests are the remains that were planted after being dentally doctored, so to speak, to resemble the dental work of Martin Bormann. And it was the Mueller gambit that was ultimately manifested successfully near the end of the war. And basically, too, the dressing up of the living as the dead in order to throw investigators off is something that Heinrich Müller has continued to exercise. In the tail end of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and again, this was published in 1981, and in one of the programs that we did, For the Record 155, the last chronologically dated material from Manning's research, this from an Israeli periodical in the early 90s, the heads of the Bormann organization after Martin Bormann's death, or certainly retirement, were his daughter Naomi, and Adolf Martin Bormann. And in the tail end of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we learn how, according to Manning, Heinrich Müller maintained the anonymity of Naomi Bormann by structuring her, quote, death, unquote, as well. Reading from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, always behind her, that is Naomi Bormann, Bormann's daughter, is the guiding hand of General Heinrich Müller, the gray eminence of security for the NSDAP, and its leader in exile. For Naomi is officially listed as dead, a device that has been utilized 6 times by Müller on behalf of Bormann, according to the Israeli Mossad. And again, due to the limitations of time, I'm going to discuss the quote death unquote of Heinrich Müller, all 3 of them, in the description for this program. Now, we're going to talk about the kicking over of the traces, the cover-up of the Bormann story, several key things in this regard. One of the ways in which the truth has been manipulated is by reducing the story to one of Bormann's personal identity. The actual story of the Bormann network and the underground Reich is one of tremendous political and economic power, and that political and economic power has been brought to bear on companies and individuals, both in the private sector and in government, who have investigated the Bormann situation. And when the corporate power and the official above-ground political pressure does not work, then things start to get rough. But the thing to understand about Borman is that the official deception has reduced the question to one of Borman's personal identity, but in fact, the real question is one of political power. We're going to return once again to Martin Borman, Nazi in exile, and we're going to read an excerpt from the actual minutes of a meeting that took place in Strasbourg, Alsace-Lorraine, on August 10th, of 1944. It was at this meeting that SS General Scheid, acting as a personal emissary for Martin Borman, met with various representatives of Third Reich industry and the SS and made plans for the post-war flight capital program that was to lead to the Borman Capital Network and the Underground Reich. And speaking of the Third Reich's plans to go underground, General Scheid, acting for Martin Borman, said as follows: "The ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war," skipping down. He, that is to say Scheid, also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. This last sentence again. He, Scheid, also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. The Hamburg America Line was one of the Bush family's businesses maintained on behalf of Nazi Germany. Now, in For the Record 370, we took a look at how first the manager of the Holland-based Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart, the Dutch-based bank used to launder Nazi and Thyssen family monies in partnership with the Bush family, well, when he found out that his bank was still under post-war Nazi control, he went over to New York to visit Prescott Bush Sr., the head at that point of the Union Banking Corporation, another along with the Hamburg America Line of the Bush family's Nazi businesses, but the manager of the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart died under strained circumstances. So too did Eddie Rover, a Dutch reporter who in the mid-1990s began researching the Bush-Borman-Nazi trail. He too began pursuing the links between the Bush family and the Thyssens in the mid-90s. He too died under very strange circumstances. This is by way of talking about how when the political pressure and when the economic pressure ceases to have effect, then things start getting nasty. And we're going to turn to, once again, the book Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, and talking about the Borman Group's use of deadly force. By the way, ultimately, when Paul Manning would not back off of the trail, his son Jerry was murdered in retaliation, according to Manning's intelligence sources, for his continued investigations. Speaking of the Borman organization's wet work, their assassinations. As security chief for the Nazi organization in South America and Europe, General Mueller keeps a close eye on the leadership and on those he feels might threaten them. Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of power are eliminated. One such termination was Fritz Bauer, formerly Attorney General for the state of Hesse in Frankfurt, a survivor of Auschwitz, and the man who tipped off the Israeli Mossad about the presence of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, who was killed on orders of General Mueller. His body was found in his bathtub and listed as death by heart attack by the Frankfurt police. The real cause? Cyanide spray that induces heart stoppage without detection, the same modus operandi that Mueller used to kill the Borman stand-ins who were placed in the Berlin freight yards in late April of 1945. Mueller's ruthlessness even today is what deters former Nazi Arthur Oxmann from altering his testimony that he saw Borman lying dead on the roadway the night of their escape from the Führer bunker May 1st and 2nd, 1945. This story had been composed by Mueller. To this day, Oxmann, the only so-called living witness to the, quote, death, unquote, of Borman in Berlin, knows that his life is in jeopardy if he reverses himself. General Mueller is thorough and has a long memory, and for a Nazi such as Oxmann to go against Mueller's original directive would make him a traitor. Retribution of a deadly nature would surely follow. When I questioned one SS man who had once worked closely with Bormann in South America about the Oxmann testimony, he said, quote, "Oxmann knows Bormann is in South America. I don't know why he persists in lying about the fact," unquote. He thought a moment, then went on, quote, "but perhaps he wants to go on living, which is reason enough," unquote. And I would note that in For the Record Program 234, we noted that George Stein, a veteran of the Wehrmacht and World War II, and himself an expert on some of the artwork that was purloined by the Nazis in World War II, declined an offer to work with the Bormann Group on the Amber Room, a priceless treasure that was given to the Tsar by, I think it was Frederick the Great of Prussia. And then when he declined to work, that is to say George Stein declined to work with the Bormann Group, his corpse was found naked, murdered in the middle of a forest with two kitchen knives still stuck in the body. So one of the reasons for the effective ongoing cover-up has to do with the fact that when the political pressure doesn't work, when the economic pressure doesn't work, then things get seriously nasty. And we're going to be talking more about how the traces were kicked over, but this is how basically those remains were planted in Berlin. And it was those remains that were used for the DNA test that was sort of like the official German government Warren report about the death of Martin Bormann. By the way, the documents that prove the Bush family's complicity, not only with Nazi industry, the Hamburg America Line, a union banking corporation, but with this post-World War II Nazi flight capital program, those are available on a website maintained by high school students in the Midwest, and they are linked to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile is available for download for free on a very compact, very usable PDF file, so please take advantage of it. And inside, too, we're going to hear more about the cover-up of not only Martin Bormann, but more importantly of the Bormann Network, and by basically reducing it to the issue of a sort of a lone nut, meaning Martin Bormann, and by saying, nah, he's dead. A huge, huge political phenomenon, one which, by the way, embraces and, I believe, defines the Bush family and the Bush administrations. That phenomenon becomes reduced to an issue of personality, and that personality is negated and swept under the rug by the cover-up that we're going to continue to describe inside, too. The website's www.spitfirelist.com, www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. A plethora of linked websites and a wealth of information and a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way of supporting the work that I'm doing than by contributing. There's no better way of fighting back, I should say, than by supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 605, Kicking Over the Traces, being recorded on July 15th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.